for Dr. Lisa Gives a Shit. And I'm Dr. Lisa. I give a shit. I really do. I don't have any of those jackets that say I don't care about you. Maybe I need a jacket that says I give a shit about you. You know, that's going to be my new line. Let me know if you want one. Anyway, thanks a lot for listening to Radio Free Brooklyn. I'm Dr. Lisa from Dr. Lisa Gives a Shit. And I just want to remind you, give us money. Give us money. Because you know what? Free speech, man. This is a nonprofit. It's tax deductible. And go to our radio show page. Check us out. RadioFreeBrooklyn.org/donate. And also, you can sponsor my show. You know what? I want to put this out there. If you want me to give you a shout out, like anything about you, a birthday, you want me to announce a show you're doing, an art show, a radio show, anything, if you give me a dollar and you put in a dollar and send me an email, I will promote it. How's that? I think that's great. I'm selling advertising. I don't know. Am I going to get in trouble for this? Tom, I'm sorry. You should see me, by the way. This is what I wanted to talk about, too, is like the sexism of air conditioning, because I came into here and I was freezing. So a good friend, the host on before me, Billy C., took down a blanket, one of those, furniture blankets that has staples in it, and I'm sitting here with it on. But I'm really excited about our guest today, which is a very well-renowned artist, visual artist, Lane Twitchell. Hi, Lane.
Hi, Lisa.
How are you feeling?
I'm feeling surprisingly calm.
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
That's because you got all your anxiety out in like the month before the show.
No, our green room session was perfect.
Oh, okay. Good. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about Lane, and then I want him to like describe his work, and then we are going to have an in-depth
knockdown drag-out interview.
Yeah, knockdown. First of all, I mean, Lane has been in therapy, right, Lane?
Yeah.
How long have you been in therapy?
Well, I don't want to disclose that, but okay. I am seeing a therapist right now.
And you have seen one, like, this isn't like you've been once or twice.
No, I've been doing it for a while, but it's also kind of what's on the table in therapy is that I'm actually pretty healthy. I have lots of people to talk to about my individual problems.
Uh-huh.
And I'm not such a mess that I really need to go back, but that's exactly maybe when you should keep doing it. I'm only going once a month, so it's
okay. So you're in the maintenance program.
Yeah, it's just a check-in.
And I love that you say you're feeling healthy, because I think you seem healthy to me, and good. That's
Thank
good.
You.
You look happy.
Thank you.
You do. So here's what I want to tell you about Lane, and then I'm going to have Lane tell you about his work, because it's better off that the artist described it. And I already let Lane know that a lot of you are fucking morons and don't necessarily, like, not like my audience is all artsy and, like, you know, studied art history. We have people that, Lane, the people that listen to this show are doers. They're not like people that
I have utmost respect for the people that listen to this show.
I'm sure. And they're not like people that like their parents send them to get art history degrees.
But I know a couple of kids like that. So don't knock those kids. I don't want to name names, but believe me.
Yeah, if you really care about art history, fine. But you know what I mean. So sure. we're not going to get so deep into this. But I do want you to understand Lane's work. And so I met Lane in Lane and I were just discussing this in 1997, because we both had the good fortune of being accepted into the Artists in the Marketplace program at the Bronx Museum, and we had quite a journey.
And the spring semester of 1997.
Right. So we've known each other over 20 years now, and Lane was clearly a star of that program. And I put a link to his website, but you can go look it up and see all the New York Times reviews he's had and all the collections. He's an extremely well-established, well-respected artist. And his work is visually complex, I'm going to say that. That's fair, right?
Yeah, and sometimes it verges to complicated. I just want to note that.
Okay.
And it's a friend of mine.
Don't you love that Lane is like kind of self-deprecating? Like
no,
he's
because
not...
I have a good friend who's a very astute critic that I have a long-going conversation with. And that's something that we've talked about, the difference between complication and complexity. And this little device that my work is built on, sometimes when it's just the folded and cut paper, you get more, it's more complex. But then I take it and I do all these like painting-ling procedures with it. And sometimes
okay, we're not talking about the mechanics of painting.
Okay.
Okay, but describe your work in very broad strokes and very quickly.
Well, the work that I've become known for is based on folded and cut paper, like snowflakes, like kids make.
Uh-huh.
That's
beautiful.
That's the first part of my elevator speech.
Okay.
And then
what are the themes? What's the idea?
So when I got out of graduate school, I was doing work of suburban landscapes. I was interested in, you know, depicting the landscape, and I was interested in, you know, the magic rectangle of representational painting. Well, I had this idea that I wanted to not depict just a single suburban house, but I wanted to depict a kind of, you know, uber vision or whatever, mm-hmm. you know, a kind of like mm-hmm. transcendent vision of all the suburban houses. And this was kind of inspired by a visit to Los Angeles in December of 1997. I thought of this idea. I was experimenting with a lot of different ways of making my work, and an artist that I really admired and still admire back in the day was an artist named Michael Ashkin, mm-hmm. who did a lot of models. He was mm-hmm. a, kind of a mad mm-hmm. model maker. And in addition to painting, I also really admired like Roxy Payne, you know, who's mm-hmm. a kind of like mm-hmm. gizmo kind of guy.
These people don't know.
So anyway, I uh-huh. came up with this idea of folding a sheet of paper and cutting right. an image into it. And when you unfold it,
like
you'd
a
have,
snowflake. Yeah, like
it's like
kids
a snowflake.
Do.
Like the kids
but like this is like really sophisticated.
And then, yeah. And so then it, and then I also happen to be from Utah. And so and this thing, which was, you know, I was using to depict this kind of landscape, it was also a snowflake. And so then it also had this resonance with, you know, this place that I was from. And then it had all of these kinds of potentials for, you know, object making and painting. And it produced a style that, a great phrase that I love is the artist Donald Judd. He once mm-hmm. said, what every artist is looking for is the concatenation that grows. Right. And a concatenation is a kind of formulation or a kind of device that, so the concatenation that grows is the kind of, as a kind of formula that one work leads to another work, which leads to mm-hmm. another work, which leads mm-hmm. to another work. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. And then the work leads you and you're just kind of like following along like,
right.
oh, I could do this. I could do that. I could do this. I could do that.
Right.
And then, you know, you look back after a certain number of years and it's like, wow, that's like the invention of a style or mm-hmm. not, maybe not invention, but the settlement upon a style. So I kind of moved over into the territory of, you know, the pattern making painters mm-hmm. like Philip Taft, mm-hmm. And granted, like yeah. Fred Tomaselli was a big influence.
Oh,
on
right.
Me.
Yeah.
And,
he's great.
And so kind of getting over there in that, uh-huh. you know, Beatrice Millais, mm-hmm. right. Mm-hmm. you know, those kinds of artists.
Okay. Okay. Anyway. Okay, so this is really, see what I'm saying, folks? He really knows a lot. No, but you know what? You are, so this is really, I find this fascinating. You are really, really smart and really, really educated. And I also think that what's so interesting about your work is that there's such an obsession to it, right?
Right.
And there's also a ridiculous dichotomy, is that the word, or paradox? I don't know. There's something really opposite about how
well that's dichotomous,
playful yeah. it is.
Yeah.
And obsession and playfulness don't necessarily line up. But I want to understand, like, what is it? I feel like you have a certain obsession about your personality, and that's... inherent in everything. Is that right?
Well, yeah, sure. I'm, you know, I can say that I'm actually from a family of obsessives.
Really? What do you mean by that?
Well, my next eldest brother was a swimmer, was like this hugely competitive amateur swimmer, which all of my close friends have known, you know, about this for years and years and years. My sibling rivalry with this brother.
Sibling rivalry.
Yeah, it's almost a kind of...
Are you both really competitive?
I know, I'd like to note that it's almost a kind of Richard Serra, you know, Tony Serra level. Although I speak to my brother, I would never want it to go to the level of like Richard and Tony Serra.
Like your brother.
I love him a lot, right?
Yeah.
But he's a very intense individual.
Like, what do you mean?
Well, he...
As are you, Lane.
And so then the one above him... Was like his,
how many boys? How many kids in your family?
So I'm at the bottom of a run of four boys.
Bottom of the run. That's very revealing boys. That you say it that way. The bottom of the run.
Yeah.
Were you picked on?
No. And so then I had a sister, an eldest sister, and so then the top brother, you know, the eldest of the four, is this brilliant snow skier.
Oh my God.
But to the point of like, he pursued snow skiing so seriously that by, you know, by the early 1980s, he'd quit because it was only, quote, it was only fun to ski in a snowstorm, right? Because he had so conquered, he'd conquered the greatest ski territory in North America, right? Little Cottonwood Canyon in Utah. And he was such a master of every run down Snowbird or Alta that it was only fun under the most punishing conditions.
Yeah, right? You know, that's funny. I feel like that about smoking pot. Like, I like to get really... pot is an old lady weed. It's like... And I like to go into the most socially complex situations sometimes stoned, because otherwise I think I'll never... I think, how am I going to, like, just to prove to myself that I can.
Sure. Yeah. I think there's an analogy. There's actually a really... analogy.
Okay, I'm not getting you off. Okay, sorry, go
no,
ahead.
No, just between that and then my brother, you know, skiing and obsessive tendencies, you know. And so, yeah, there are times when I've just pursued my work to the point where I'm just blasting around so many layers of paint. I have this drawing, you know, this cut sheet of paper that I've made that's so complicated, I can't even see it. You know, the studio becomes like a storm. It's like a visual storm.
So what happens? Like, do you get lost in making your work?
At times, yeah. But I'm also kind of going back and forth as I'm, you know, a little older and more experienced in the studio. I like the work to still have that element of obsession, but I don't really push myself through those. You know, I'm too old to push myself through those routines that you do, you know, when you're a young painter.
Okay, so
mid-30s.
Did you ever have a period where you went into the studio and then you looked up and it was like 2 days later or something?
Well, not exactly, but yeah, I mean, of course. Yeah, of course. I mean,
I want to understand about your family. I mean, that's kind of interesting. So there's four boys and one girl. And how... And where's the girl fit in?
Well, and unfortunately, my sister was actually diagnosed 30 years ago. She was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis.
Oh.
So it was a very long...
Oh, that's hard.
It abbreviated her life, and she's passed on.
How old were you when she was diagnosed?
I was actually a freshman in college.
Oh.
I remember that. I was on the campus of the University of Utah, and I actually made this drawing. You know, I made this very somber drawing of this crooked tree. Kind of reflecting on, you know, my sister's grave illness and this diagnosis.
Resolved itself. So there were four boys and you were the youngest.
Yeah, so then I'm the youngest of these four boys.
And were all the boys really competitive?
Yeah, I think so. I seem to be the only one that, like, really recognizes it, which is... I don't know, you know, being part of a family and being close to your siblings and so forth, it's a very confusing dynamic, right?
For anybody, that's a lot of boys.
Right, yeah.
So I'm trying to picture this. So, and the competition involved sports, right?
Right, but this is what's amusing is we're all... with the exception of the oldest one, who was actually in Little League football, we excel at balance sports rather than ball sports. And so you see, swimming is actually a highly sophisticated balance sport.
Oh, I did not know that.
And then the next oldest brother, the second one down, he was also a diver. And then see, the oldest brother is a skier, right? And we're all very good, you know. And these three, I'm not so good at water sports. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of a big divide between.
Did you have a sport?
No, well, that takes us to art, actually.
Right? Oh, and that's why he became an artist.
Exactly.
Seriously?
Yes, and this is part of like...
Wait, let me just get this clear. You were the only talented... You said your father was an accountant or something but were you the only creative one in the family? You know, creative producer, as they say.
Yeah, I mean, I guess my sister was actually a creative producer. We actually just unearthed, my cousin just passed on some drawings that she'd had in a filing cabinet of these amazing drawings that my sister had made as a fashion design student.
Oh, your sister was fashion design student.
And they were stunning. Actually, mm-hmm. I'd never seen them because mm-hmm. she'd made them in high school and they just got put away. Right.
So she was talented at drawing.
Yeah, she actually was like a very sophisticated stylist and she was an expert seamstress.
Did your sister participate in the competition, the family sibling competition?
Well, no, because in some, no, well,
she
not really,
girl.
Not really. She was a girl. And also in some ways, you know, she triggered it. And so the oldest boy is he's the complete opposite, right? So Anne, my sister Anne, attended Brigham Young University.
Right.
Right. And and we get into the whole culture of the Intermountain West and, you know, the LDS people and so forth. But so my sister, you know, attended the church school. Mm-hmm. And my brother Dal, God bless him, I love the man. You know, he, like many people of his generation, you know, he said, screw college. I'm just going to get a season pass to Alta and collect unemployment during the winter
Alta,
and work construction.
Which is the
ski resort.
Ski resort.
Yeah. And so Dal spent his collegiate years skiing, right? He went the complete opposite direction of his perfect sister, Anne. Because my sister was so good and so...
Right.
You know, so happy to be part of that community.
But you're obviously, the point I'm making really is that you're obviously from a highly intelligent, obsessive family. And is that a biology thing?
Yes, I think so. I think so. I think so. I think so. And it's, and this is also kind of interesting to note. I'm fine with this. You know, it is part of a process, but both my parents have passed away in the last couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
Mom passed away last summer. Oh, Dad passed away in 2015. Right. They were both 89.
Oh, good.
You know, Mom was very happy to follow Dad, you know, into the world beyond. And so that all resolved itself really well. But it causes some reflection. My mom used to say, you know, you never grow up until your parents die.
Oh, that's so true.
It's kind of a chilling thing to say, right?
Yeah.
And so, but it also gives you, you know, it gives you certain license.
True.
It gives you certain license to go out into the world and say, well, you know, here's what I think, right?
Right.
And, you know, depending on your family situation, if you have a spouse that you're responsible to, or you're sort of guarding things, you don't want your kids, you know, to hear your public statements or whatever. But not having your parents around, you can kind of talk about them and talk about yourself in a new way.
Mm-hmm.
And obsessive tendencies, it comes from my dad's family. It comes from my dad. My mother was, if there's a fundamental sort of humor, you know, or psychological thing, I would say that stubbornness, kind of like rock solid, unmoving, stoic mm-hmm. stubbornness mm-hmm. characterizes my mother and my mm-hmm. mother's family, mm-hmm. right? These are LDS pioneers. You know,
what's LDS stand for?
The Latter-day Saints, the Mormons.
Mormons, because you were brought up a Mormon.
Yeah, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And
okay.
So I try to use, you know, their preferred, more respected term, LDS.
Oh, well, that's good. See, anyway, we learned something there. I'm glad I asked.
And so they, you know, they pushed handcarts to the you know, the Rocky Mountains.
Right.
And you just had to be stoic. And you had to be stubborn to get that job done.
Yeah.
Well, my dad's family, they represent a completely different, you know, kind of American family. And, you know, my grandmother was much too high strung. She never would have tolerated pushing a handcart on my paternal grandmother, right? Mm-hmm. And she was a painter. She was a Sunday painter, right? And she liked fancy things. And so she had a taste for, you know, the fancy in life, right? Mm-hmm. And so the sort of the fanciness, you know, the obsessive tendencies that gets channeled into, you know, fashion and decorating and making things to hang over couches. And
so she made a lot of stuff?
Well, I think, yeah, I mean, she was a, you know, she actually was a painter. We actually have a whole body of work.
So you do have a lot of creative people. So there was a creative thing, but you were able, but that's something that you really focused on. But also, I'm wondering.
Oh, but then also to give my mom's side credit, right? Yeah. She actually has a cousin who's a world-renowned violinist. And and they were actually like,
also obsessive.
They were actually like huge musicians on my mother's side.
So there's a lot of genetics in there.
Yeah.
But also your brothers were all really talented at sports. So I can see how if you're talented at sports and you live in Utah, which is a great place for sports, I imagine you might just. But you being the youngest, what was that like? You were, because when you're growing up, you're the smallest, you're the least capable, right? You're the least capable of being like if your brother's a great athlete, you're too
right.
Little.
And so, yes. Yeah, so when I could learn, when I discovered I could draw in junior high, you know, it was the solution to this whole problem about like, what's my place in the world? You know, we none of us are particularly good at ball sports.
Right.
So we couldn't excel. None of us excelled at basketball. None of us excelled at baseball. And I have a very fond memory of being in junior high and hearing some older tough kids, you know, rip on my brother and saying, oh, he's a really crappy baseball player. And feeling like a note of like really pride and being like, yeah, but he could like swim you under the ground or whatever. Right. He's a fantastic swimmer. But knowing that, you know, we're all like basically, you know, handicapped when it comes to, you know, baseball, basketball, and we can sort of play football a little bit, but then the problem is that water sports are a subdivision amongst other, you know, balance sports. So I gravitated towards bicycling.
Uh-huh.
And as an adult, I've embraced snow skiing.
Oh, nice.
But my brother's exceptional, you know, development as a swimmer, it triggered a little bit of a neurosis in me as, you know, I mean, he started swimming when he was 8. I was 5, you know, so it was really, and by the time he was 12, he was the best swimmer in like 9 state, you know,
wow.
United States. And he used to take first or second and win High Point Trophy. It went on for like 5 years.
Oh my God.
Where he always won. And I remember going to this swim meet once. I love this story. And these two other kids, they were looking at the heat sheet, right? And they were looking at like who they had to swim against. And one of them pointed up and was like, oh, I have to swim against Twitchell. I hate that guy. He always wins. And I was so, again, I was so proud of him.
Aww.
You know, I was so proud of him.
Right.
I was like, yeah, he's the best, man. And he was an obsessive. I mean, he was an obsessive
obviously.
About swimming.
Well, yeah.
And he used to work out with the high school kids. And he has this very great story about when he was 12 years old, he was in junior high, he was working out with the high school kids, and he sat down on the side of the pool and he started crying because he'd made himself so tired.
Really?
And the coach, the high school coach, came over and said, Kip, you go home for a week, and I don't want to see you in the water.
Oh, wow.
For a week.
Wow.
Because you're really overdoing it.
Right.
Well, so then, you know, I had this marvelous art teacher in Ogden, Utah. His name is Mark Woodfield. He ran this incredible art department where we had like 16 different categories of things to do. And he just ignited this thing in me that it was just like, and I was like, wow, I can be as good at this as Kip is, you know, at swimming.
That's interesting. So you found, which wasn't a physical thing because as a smaller, younger boy, you're not going to be able to compete. But how did you guys handle it as a family unit? Were you made fun of? Did you feel inadequate?
No.
You're just proud
of
them?
No, not at all. It has nothing to do with my brother, really. he couldn't help the fact that he was really good
at
this.
Of course.
And then all this attention just pours onto him.
Right.
And my parents, like, they can't leave me home. You know, I have to be taken to these swim meets.
Right.
And so you're just in this environment where it's like, and you know, in competitive swimming, it's, if anybody that's been involved in it, you know, it's a whole world of, like, you know, and we go for, you know, you have to go for a week and whatever. And
because there's traveling teams.
Yeah.
Right?
And so then my dad would take me off and we'd try to do other things or, you know.
Right.
And then eventually I got to be, you know, once he was in high school and I was in junior high, I didn't really have to go to the meets anymore.
Right.
So then it kind of split apart and I was you know, relieved from having to sit in these, like, you know, hot swimming
pools.
Does he
still swim or what? What
does
he do now?
He's a banker.
So he's a real overachiever.
Well, yeah, a little bit. But you know, he's
does he still live in Utah?
No, he lives in Dallas.
Mm-hmm.
And he's in finance and he does swim. He has a pool in his backyard, actually.
Nice.
And interestingly, though, he doesn't snow ski. So this is something I've worked through recently, is that his swimming, they used to do this on the Intermountain West, and they're not allowed to do it anymore. Kids that were good at sports, their sports coaches would ask them to not snow ski for fear of injury.
Oh.
And they've since stopped that practice. But snow skiing actually fell victim to my brother's, you know, learning how to swim so well. And then because my dad was older and my dad had a motorboat, we ended up privileging water sports in my family as opposed to snow skiing. And this is actually something I've just, and this has honestly been a topic in therapy.
I knew we'd get there.
Like, to take it back to therapy,
yes.
Right? This has actually been a topic about sort of reflecting on, you know, how great snow skiing is. And just, like, it's the most amazing activity anybody could ever engage in. And I would hope all of your, you know, listeners would take up snow skiing and they'd be so much happier if they did. And how, because my dad, you know, just because of the economics of the family and he had a motorboat and we'd take vacations in the summer and my mom would rather sit in a motorboat than, you know, go up to a ski resort.
Or hang out at a pool, an indoor hut.
Yeah, and skiing's very expensive, you know, and it's kind of complicated and so forth.
Wow,
and so
equipment.
We didn't take up snow skiing when I was a kid. I only took it up after I'd moved to New York. You know.
So you ski now?
Yeah.
Where do you go?
I love Hunter. I think I'd like to get maybe an Empire frequent skier pass this year.
So you go to Bel Air. Really go regularly.
Yeah, we went to Whiteface last year, and then also earlier in the year. And this actually goes back to the work.
I'm going to stop you right there because we're going to do a station ID.
Sounds good.
But before we do the station ID, I want to, you have some shows up now and I want people to know what they are.
Yes.
So can you tell us where they can see your work right at the moment?
Okay. So I have some work at a retail fabric design center called Fujio over on Park and 23rd, and then I'm in a group show.
Does that have regular hours or what kind of hours?
Yeah, it is actually regular business hours. It's actually Monday to Friday, 1 to 6.
So it's like a store hours.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, exactly.
And how long is that going to be up till?
It's actually up till December.
Wow,
till the middle of December.
Beautiful. Yeah. Oh, that's wonderful. And where else?
And then I'm in a group show here at 56 Bogart.
Right here in our neighborhood.
And right in the neighborhood. At Gallery Man K.
At Gallery Man K.
Yeah.
And is that's on the ground floor?
Yeah, and it's been up. It's a group exhibition called Small.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been up through June and I think it's open through July by appointment.
Cool. Well, so okay, now here comes the station ID. So thank you for listening to Radio Free Brooklyn. This is Dr. Lisa, and you're listening to Dr. Lisa Gives a Shit. My guest today is Lane Twitchell, who is a very well-respected and brilliant and original. I don't know. He has a lot of... Go to his website. And what is it? Is it Lane Twitchell?
.com.
.com?
I have
That's
the domain.
T-W-I-T... C-H-E-L-L, two L's.
Like Mitchell with a T-W.
Oh, look at that. And also, I want to remind you guys that, you know what? We have this amazing mobile app, and it's really great because we have so many different shows, and there's so many great people. And if you get the mobile app on your phone, you can, like, just join us and, like, hear us and hear what we're up to, because, like, you could turn it on anytime, and you could, like, in the evenings, you could get, like, such great different kinds of music. We have more talk shows in the day, but you can, like, we have such a great variety that you are guaranteed to find stuff that is going to expand your horizons exponentially, okay? So just go to radiofreebrooklyn.org/iPhone or radiofreebrooklyn.org/Android and listen to us and get the noise from, like, the rest of the world that isn't pleasant right now. Take a break from that. So back to you, Lane. So, you know, there's something I really wanted to, we had talked about this, and I wanted to hear your perspective on this, because, so we were talking before in the green room, as you say, and you had mentioned, so we established that you were brought up in the Mormon church, or whatever you call it, LPD, DBL, whatever, whatever the respectful name is, Church of Latter-day
LDS.
LDS.
which is, come on, it's amusingly close to LSD.
Oh, you're right, you're
LDS,
right.
LSD, yeah. Sorry, Mormons,
yeah,
I didn't
no,
make
you're
it
right.
up.
So you were brought up in...
Blame Albert Hoffman for that.
And I'm assuming that you were part of that community. It wasn't like you had a whole lot of objectivity about it. It was just the way you were. Your family, right? So you were brought up in that world, which you know, all us East Coasters find fascinating. But there's a specific aspect of it which relates to us as creative people, which I thought was really interesting that I wanted to ask, to try to understand so we could all understand it, which was that I'm going to use the word proselytizing. So you're that community has a practice of, like you were saying, your grandmother didn't have the patience for it, but your mother did. Like, you guys have to go out and hand out information.
You're
saying that your mother was stubborn because she needed that kind of...
Well, now that doesn't really have that much to do with my mother, there's a common kind of community phrase, you know, promulgated by the leader of the LDS people in the 1970s, who was a man named Spencer Kimball, and he once gave this sermon, as people would call it, and he coined the phrase, every member a missionary.
Mm-hmm.
And since the founding of the Latter-day Saint movement, which was by Joseph Smith Jr. In Fayetteville, New York, in 1830.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, it started here in New York.
Oh, that's so late. That's a really new movement.
Yeah, upstate New York. Yeah, mm-hmm. And then
I didn't know that.
Yeah. So it actually started in New York, and so, mm-hmm. but they've had a long kind of almost communal compulsion to go out and, you know, round up followers, so to speak. So this continues. And of course, you know, in today's world, many, many people know the great Broadway play Book of Mormon.
Right.
Which is all about...
I don't
about,
even think about that.
But that's what it's about.
Right. Oh,
right?
Really?
That's what it's about. It's about, like, those kids and, you know, they put on the white shirts and they go out and, you know, proclaim to the world.
Well, there's stereotypes about it for sure. We know that.
Well, no. Yeah. Anyway, mm-hmm.
So anyway, the thing that I'm curious about is that we were talking about putting your work out there, putting yourself, like being on the radio, putting yourself out there.
Yeah.
And I was just wondering, like, I think that is the idea of putting yourself and your work out there for creative people everywhere. I mean, whether you're a visual artist, certainly a performer, even if you're a writer, no matter what you do, a poet, we all make this work for, even if we're making it really and it's personal to us, there's always this thought of an audience. How are people going to see it? How are people going to react? And in today's world, I think it's a really, it's becoming a very layered and complex kind of, you know, pursuit, because how much do you do it, and when do you do it, and how much is doing justice to the work, and how much of it is it just to get people to, you know, to get the recognition, to have your ego stroked, and how much control do you want to have over your image? And all this stuff is so complicated and so important and so coming at us really fast. And I think what you were indicating, that the practice that you were brought up with has influenced the way that you put your work out there now. And I wanted to hear about how it's influenced you.
Yeah. Oh, thank you. Well, yeah.
Can you explain first, like, how, what the practice was that you were brought up with? Because all I have is a stereotype.
Oh, well, what's your stereotype?
My stereotype is like kind of what you said. Like, honestly, my whole impression of it is just, I mean, I've lived in Manhattan most of my life, sadly. I don't have like a lot of experience, but I would walk past the Mormon church on Lincoln Center, near Lincoln Center, and there would be people outside, and they look like great people, and, you know, I mean, that was just, oh, those people, that's what they do. That culture
What I've ultimately settled on in describing the LDS people to people here in New York is that Mitt Romney is like an Orthodox Jew, right? Mm-hmm. Like out on Ocean Avenue, right? Mm-hmm. He's not Hasidic, right? Doesn't have the temple locks.
Yeah, right.
Right? Doesn't wear the vest or whatever. And I don't know the names of all the, you know, the Jewish accoutrement, right? But if I talk about, you know, the Jewish culture, right, in relationship to the Mormon culture, standard LDS, Salt Lake City, you know, members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, they're most like, culturally, they're like Orthodox Jews that live out on Ocean Avenue, in that it's all, you know, community-centered. There are very clear codes of, you know, behavior, and even, you know, that even spills over to dress, you know, the underclothing and so forth. And it is no more interesting or less interesting than Orthodox Judaism. Now, depending on how interesting you might think Orthodox Judaism is, or those people, or what they do, I think drawing a comparison to the LDS people, you know, is fair to say they are no more or less interesting.
So are you talking, when then, you say Orthodox Jew, I just want to be clear, are you saying like Hasidim Jew?
No, you're saying Orthodox Jew,
highly religious, but like you wouldn't necessarily know they're Jews.
Yeah, but you can tell, right? When you go to Kennedy and they're in all black, right? You can tell the difference between an Orthodox Jew, right?
And a Hasidic Jew.
Now, see, the Mormon people, they also have their Hasids in that they're polygamist towns in Utah, right? On the outskirts, in the mountain valleys and so forth. So the Mormon, you know, community, they have a Hasidic kind of component, but I'm saying like Mitt Romney.
Right.
Mitt Romney, he's like a guy that you see out in Kennedy, and he's wearing black. His wife's wearing nothing but black. The kids are in black, you know, and like they're in nice clothing all the time, right? They don't wear anything but black. And the men always have the yarmulke on. They don't do the temple locks. They don't do the big, or they might do the big beards. I don't know. But the ladies, I also mean that kind of as a compliment, because I think Orthodox Jews are very well dressed. They always
that's nice.
You know, they wear nice clothes.
Yeah, I'm a
nice
Jew. I'm going to take that.
You know,
that.
They wear like dark.
They do dress
they
well.
They do.
You're right.
Yeah, especially at that Orthodox level.
Yeah,
right?
They've got good taste. Look at the ladies. They always have nice clothes.
Yeah, and she's always in. She has like a little fur hat on. There's a little fur collar on the coat
Very
or whatever.
And,
yeah,
and
they're
stylish.
Like that. And then they're nothing. You know, it's again, it's no more freakish or interesting than that.
Right. Well, the point that I'm focusing on though is for lack of a better word, and it sounds pejorative, and I don't mean it that way, but proselytizing, like the actual, like what I was interested in is what you said about promoting your own work in relationship to how you were brought up, where you had to put kind of a face on it or something in order to, were you, like, here's what I'm picturing. I'm picturing you, your mom, and maybe like four boys or five kids standing there with pamphlets or something. Did you guys do
no,
that?
No.
What did you guys do? Did you do
no,
any
so
of
you
that?
No, so you don't know.
I don't know. I'm trying to find out.
And you don't know anything about the play, right? The Book of Mormon.
No, I
the
don't.
Okay.
I don't. I, so should, the musical, I didn't know I was going
to
know about
no,
that.
No, no. So the LDS people have a whole standardized, you know, routine. When the young men and young women are in their early 20s, you know, they sign up for... you know, this period of full-time, you know, proselytizing.
Did you do that?
I did.
Okay,
yes.
So when you were, this is what I want to hear about as it relates to you. What was your experience? Is that okay? Can we talk about that? He's laughing. I don't know.
Not really. I mean,
I want to hear about it. It sounds fascinating.
This is where my good friend Christian Viveros says, Lane, stop, you know, you're getting in front of the work.
Okay, well, right. Let's not talk about that. Let's talk about, you know, we don't even have to talk about it in that way. We can talk about it. What I'm curious is how you feel about putting your... This is what I'm going to tell you, Lane. I'm curious about how you feel about putting yourself out there and putting your work out there, because I'm just going to say, like, as a guest on my show, as somebody who has so much to talk about and is so well respected, I have never had anyone and I think it's partly, I'm trying to say this so it doesn't sound like criticism, but, and I don't mean it that way, but I just am curious about why. Okay, here's the thing, folks. We love Lane. Lane, are you laughing or crying? I hope you're laughing. You're laughing. It's my observation.
I feel like I'm skiing in a snowstorm.
Okay, good. Here's what I want to tell you, folks. This is about Lane. I'm going to talk about Lane, and even though he's sitting right here. I have never in my life had a guest of any sort as obsessed about what we were going to talk about and trying to control the situation as I have with Lane Twitchell. This is the truth. And Lane and I have known each other over 20 years. We have a great relationship, a lot of mutual respect. There is no cause for any of this. It has nothing to do with me. And Lane is an obsessive guy. And I even called Lane to try and, like, chill it out. And I never call anyone. I mean, I would if they wanted me to. But, like, I was like, oh, God, Lane doesn't have to think about this that hard. So this is what I'm trying to get to, Lane. What happened there? What happened in your brain?
Well, that I don't know. But Lisa, the thing that we're sticking on is, see, we're talking about this experience of me going around and knocking on doors that happened, you know, all these years ago. And we're not talking about, you know, where we are right now.
Well, I'm wondering, well, we are and we aren't, because I'm wondering what was going on in your head. And I thought that when you mentioned that, before we were on the air, you were mentioning that, you know, because of your background, that affected how you put yourself out there.
Yes, it did.
And that's why I'm asking about it.
Right. And this is foregrounding what the nervousness was about, right?
Okay,
is that in the past, you see, when I've talked about my work, this tiny aspect of the fact that, you know, I'm descended from these people, you know, that did this thing.
Right.
And then have their kids go out and, you know, do this other thing, and then, you know, blah blah blah. I've always been too willing to talk about that culture. Rather than, you know, all the other things that a person can talk about in the world. And maybe, you know, more specifically, what I think is happening in, you know, my painting.
Exactly.
And so I want to just, you know, bring up this phrase that in Ed Ruscha's first retrospective at the San Francisco MoMA.
Okay, no, we don't have time for this. We have 15 minutes.
Well, no, Dave Hickey just wrote this line where he said, in the introductory essay, he said, it's never just the work. It's never just the art. It's also the performance of the artist.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. Now that's what you're getting at.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes,
and that's exactly what you're getting at. And that was the first thing that I wanted to, you know, when you were talking about the complexity of performance and socializing the work. And then we went into this sort of 10-minute, you know, standoff where you wanted to talk about that culture. And I'm sort of holding you at bay, and I was on this side of the mic laughing a little bit because what I'm trying to say is, no, let's not talk about that anymore. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the work. Let's talk about the new work. You know, I just closed this great exhibition at Father Knows Best. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I have this work up at, you know, Gallery Mankay, and then I have this work up at Fujio.
Okay.
And instead of talking about, you know, the dressing habits of Mitt Romney.
Well, I didn't bring that up.
You did.
Okay. But here's the thing, Lane. I'm trying to work this out with you because I think, and thank you for saying that. I think that was really honest. But here's the thing. I do agree that, you know, putting Mormon in your biography where there's no, where, you know, like saying that your work is done by a Mormon, that's bullshit. Who cares? And that's not interesting. And it also distracts from the work. I agree with that 100%. But I do think what is relevant is your life experience. And I think that, like, now that we're talking about it, I think that it would be great if we could work, we could work this out, because I don't think that you're by not talking about being Mormon, or you're not, it's not about being Mormon. It's your life experience, and your life experience is unique. Like, I was abused by my parents. Okay. I could talk about that. There's no religion specifically attached to it, but it's part of what makes me unique and has followed me through my life. So I'm just saying that, like, this is a really fundamental part of who you are. And it's the actions, the practice that you went through, not the label.
I agree with you. And I think part of the challenge for any contemporary artist is to find the elements of their personal narrative which intersect in a general sense with other people. And to learn how to, talk to a therapist about the things that they talk about too much that nobody seems to get. And eventually, you kind of have to learn. See, the reason I'm hesitant to talk about LDS culture is because I've learned over the years that nobody gets it anyway. They don't really understand, and it doesn't really go anywhere.
I think talking about what Mitt Romney wears is so irrelevant. I agree with you. And right. I think, did I try to cut you off? I should have. But the point is that I'm trying to talk to you about your experience. So we can't completely ignore.
No.
But I think also it's important for you to talk about your experience, but not. And we're not really even talking about your work that much, really. I mean, in a way, we're trying to find out. I just want to know why the fuck you were so obsessed about this coming on the show.
Well, in part because, like I said, I feel like in times past, you know, when I've made public statements or, you know, and so forth, I've talked about things extraneous to the work.
Right.
And that I've been made aware of that through, you know, some friends, that talking about things extraneous to the work, but also, you know, we started our green room session talking about how difficult it is to talk about art on the radio.
Right, and that's not what this show is about.
Right. And so then I'm kind of approaching this trying to think about, you know, as many artists are doing, this idea about, you know, contextualizing the work, or, you know, this issue of it's not just the art, it's also the performance of the artist, talking about these exhibition opportunities that I have. And the give and take here has been, it's been fantastic.
Excellent.
Really, it's been fantastic.
Right.
And it really has been like skiing in a snowstorm, because there have been times where I'm like, I don't know where this is going, but you know, I trust you completely.
Thanks.
Now, to take it back to our shared history, I have to own up to the fact that when we had our Bronx museum show,
right,
I displayed a body of work called 12 Famous Mormons.
Right.
Right. And that I have, you know, a certain interpretation as to why I made that work, mm-hmm. you know. And to me, as an adult, as a, you know, the, you know, we're talking 25 years ago, right?
Right, yeah.
I would say that to me, the part of it that was more interesting was the part about fame and less about, you know, Mormonism, because fame is a concept that applies to America in general.
Right.
Right. And so I think what we're kind of encouraged to do as artists is to look at the place that we're from in this giant country and then extrapolate from our region some sort of distinction that we can then expand into work that applies in a larger national conversation. Does that make sense?
Yes, yes. And that's what I'm trying to do. That's what I was trying to do with you about Mormonism, to get down to the fundamental, like, human interaction of it and the psychology and how it makes you feel and how it is being from that background and being kind of like the only, you know, we don't know a lot of Mormons, or like we, the general New York City people, don't know. But I also want to, it's occurring to me, like, see, being Mormon for you is kind of like what I'm going to call now the big tit aspect of you. Because if you have, like, really huge tits as a female, that's all people care about. That's all people see. That's all they want to talk about. I don't have them, but that's the impression I get.
Right. And having
and being
having
a Mormon
your,
is, like, well, big tits.
Well, having your BFA from the University of Utah.
Yeah.
And I know people that graduated from Brigham Young University, and they went on to get advanced degrees, and they actually leave their undergraduate degree off.
Right.
Because they don't want to hand the paper across the table.
Right.
And to be immediately like, oh, you went to Brigham Young. Oh, you're, and then it leads down this whole side corridor.
Right. Right.
Of issues.
Perfect side corridor.
That they don't necessarily want to talk about.
Right. And I understand that. And I think that you were exploited when you were young. I think you were. I think that you were exploited about your Mormonism, because I think a lot of people, you know, nice, handsome young man, interesting work. Oh, it's like this layer that made a lot, that was that, like, it was saleable or whatever.
But I have to own up to my own culpability in that I, you know, I played into it to a certain degree.
Yeah.
Right.
I don't know.
Like that work that I made, right, you know, that I showed at the Bronx Museum. Right.
Well,
if I didn't want to talk about that culture, then I wouldn't have made that work. But the solution, and this was really like what's at the heart of the problem, is attending art school at the University of Utah, mm-hmm. you could make work about, I would say, any subject matter. You know, they really prided themselves on being, you know, a wide open liberal, you know, in the best liberal sense, right? You could take on any subject matter and feel confident that your colleagues in, you know, the crit would tolerate it, right? But if you brought in somehow the Mormon story or Mormon culture or Mormon history or something,
right,
which is right outside the door, right?
Right.
There's such an antipathy towards it within,
really?
At the University of Utah.
Really?
Yeah, because
I didn't know that.
Well, the University of Utah tries to be like the anti Brigham Young.
Oh, right? I didn't know that. Yeah.
And so now that I'm going back and like retracing and getting back to where I was at the Bronx Museum, a lot of that early work was a reaction to having been gone to this art school where this prevailing culture was essentially verboten as subject matter.
That's very funny.
You know, for work, uh-huh. you know, for any kind of personal project or something, or,
right.
you know.
Right. But I'm also saying that when you made that work 25 years ago, that was really sensible, appropriate work because you were in that space. You had
right.
to process that, and making art is how you processed it. And, you know, people jumped on that and you were, you know, whatever.
Right.
But I'm just going to say that my sense from our conversation today is that it being a Mormon, and it's not being, forget about the M word or that whatever, the experience that you had growing up is unique to you, and it's notable to you. And it's notable in understanding your work and everything else. But you can control the narrative just like anybody does. And I don't think not talking about it is the answer. I think have you talked about this in therapy? Have you thought about like how to integrate that your childhood, your background as a Mormon into who you are today? Have you talked about that? Because
no, I mean I've worked all of that out.
You have,
in my life, I've worked. I'm not a Mormon. I'm an ex-Mormon.
Right, right.
I am not raising my son, you know, in the LDS tradition. I am completely out to my family as far as my skepticism, you know.
Right,
but I'm
right.
still like fully yeah. embraced by them, you yeah. know, as a family member, and also, you know, my mother's family, which is the LDS side. It's actually a gigantic family that's so big, not everybody in the family is even a practicing, you know, member of the church.
Right.
Anymore,
and that's great. Right? We only have 3 minutes, so I still have to tell people about the next show. But so the thing is, that is really beautiful, and that's taken a lot of work to integrate it into your life. But have you integrated it into your story about yourself to other people?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. Well, I'm wondering, because this is why I'm asking this question, is because we wound up butting heads on it, or I wound up feeling that this is my feeling. My feeling is it's hard for you to talk about being a Mormon without putting it in the without talking about it and how it affects you specifically, mentally, emotionally, and in your, you know, the way you present yourself.
Well,
you don't agree with that? I mean, I'm not right.
I don't know.
I have no formal training. It's some, anyway, that's the feeling.
We ended up talking about the one thing that we had sort of said at the green room
we weren't going to talk about. I know.
See, it happened again.
Well, this is why I'm thinking that maybe because it's not resolved.
No, it's not. It's because I kept trying to sort of satisfy your questions and sort of put them off at the same time.
Hmm.
And I never got the sense that I really satisfied your initial inquiry and my attempts to, you know, move the conversation on to a different place to talk about perhaps, you know, performance as an artist generally, and to get off of, you know, the specifics of my Rocky Mountain regionality.
No.
You know.
Are you mad at me? I feel terrible.
No. It's just that, you know, you could be from the South and, you know, be one thing, or, you know, be... Again, it's also like if the power center of the United States, you know, 100 years from now turns out to be Denver, and everybody in New York, you know, loses all their power, and everybody from your ethnic tradition immigrates to Denver,
mm-hmm.
all they're going to want to talk about is being a Jew, right?
No, but it's about the resistance too. Anyway, Lane, I thank you for coming on. We'll have to have another session about this where this is unresolved for sure. And we will. So stick around and listen to Lost and Rewound, which is a fabulous show by my good friend